Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is committed to bringing you the stories and perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. From the peace activists demanding an end to war, to indigenous leaders fighting to stop fossil fuel extraction and save the planet. Our independent reporting is only possible because we're funded by you, not by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war or gun violence, not by the oil, gas, coal, or nuclear companies when we cover the climate crisis. We count on your generous support to keep Democracy Now! Going. Please make your donation of $5, $10, or more at democracynow.org. Every dollar counts. Thank you so much. We're counting on you. Stay safe. From New York, this is Democracy Now! Voters went to the polls in five states Tuesday. Many chose progressive Democratic candidates like Summer Lee in Pennsylvania, who hopes to become the first Black woman to represent the state in Congress. We'll speak with Lever's David Sirota, who says Democratic leaders are joining with oligarchs to try to permanently destroy the progressive movement. And we'll talk to former Bernie Sanders advisor Nina Turner, who just lost her Ohio congressional primary after facing massive spending and attacks from super PACs. Then we go to the front lines of the Battle of Donbass in Ukraine to speak with independent reporter Billy Nessen in Severodonetsk, which is under constant attack.
Okay, well, this is the explosions now, I would say. Probably 3 minutes of mostly shells going back and forth between the Ukrainian forces and the Russian forces. The city of 130,000 is a strategic point, a barometer of which way this thing is going to go. If the Ukrainians can hold the city, I think it's the end of any Russian advances, at least in this part of the country.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden visited Buffalo, New York, Tuesday, 3 days after an 18-year-old white supremacist shot dead 10 people at a supermarket in the heart of the Black community. Biden denounced the attack as an act of domestic terrorism and described white supremacy as a poison.
Look, we've seen the mass shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, El Paso, Texas, and Pittsburgh, last year in Atlanta, this week in Dallas, Texas, and now in Buffalo, New York. White supremacy is a poison. It's a poison running through it. It really is.
Biden's trip to Buffalo comes as more details emerge about how the gunman spent months plotting to carry out the mass shooting. Multiple news outlets are reporting the gunman used the online platform Discord to share details about his plot with a small group of people about 30 minutes before the massacre. No one saw the messages, is known to have alerted law enforcement to the imminent attack. In Texas, police have arrested a man in connection with last week's shooting at a hair salon in the Koreatown neighborhood of Dallas. Three Korean women were injured in the shooting. Authorities are investigating the shooting as a hate crime. The suspect's girlfriend said her partner had delusions about Asian people. A new report by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives shows there's been a massive surge in guns made and sold in the United States over the past two decades. The number of guns produced in the U.S. has jumped from about 4 million in 2000 to over 11 million in 2020. Demand for semi-automatic handguns has grown the fastest. By one count, there are now over 400 million guns in the U.S. That's more than one gun for every adult and child living in the country. Voters went to the polls for primary elections in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Oregon, North Carolina, and Idaho on Tuesday. In Pennsylvania, State Senator Doug Mastriano won the Republican gubernatorial primary. He's a far-right politician who is endorsed by Donald Trump, an election denier. Mastriano took part in the January 6 protests outside the Capitol and funded charter buses to take supporters to Washington, D.C. ahead of the insurrection. He's long claimed Trump won the 2020 election. If Mastriano wins in November, he could appoint Pennsylvania's next Secretary of State to oversee elections. Pennsylvania's closely watched Republican Senate primary is too close to call. Television doctor Dr. Mehmet Oz, who is backed by Trump, has a narrow lead over hedge fund executive Dave McCormick. The winner will face Democrat John Fetterman, who defeated Congressmember Connor Lamb, even though Lamb had been endorsed by much of Pennsylvania's Democratic establishment. Fetterman, who is currently Pennsylvania's lieutenant governor, had to miss his victory party Tuesday night. He suffered a stroke Friday and spent Election Day in a hospital where he had a pacemaker implanted. In other races, the progressive candidate Summer Lee has declared victory over Steve Irwin in a closely watched congressional race in Pennsylvania, but the race has not yet been called. Irwin received major funding from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the Democratic Majority for Israel. Lee is aiming to become the first Black woman to represent Pennsylvania in Congress. In North Carolina, the Trump-backed Republican Congressmember Madison Cawthorn lost on Tuesday. The 26-year-old was seen as a rising star of the Republican Party, but his campaign faltered following a number of scandals, including allegations of insider trading. Meanwhile, in Kentucky, Charles Booker has won the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, becoming the first Black candidate in Kentucky to win a major party nomination for Senate. He'll face Republican Senator Rand Paul in November. We'll have more on these races and other results from Tuesday after headlines. Finland and Sweden formally applied to join NATO today, ending decades of neutrality. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg described the event as a historic moment.
And I warmly welcome the requests by Finland and Sweden to join NATO. You are our closest partners, and your membership in NATO would increase our shared security.
If NATO approves Sweden and Finland as members, it would more than double the border between NATO countries and Russia. Current NATO members share a 750-mile border with Russia. Finland alone has an 830-mile border with Russia. In news from the Ukrainian city of Mariupol, the Russian military says nearly 1,000 Ukrainian fighters surrendered in total this week at the Azovstal steel plant, where they'd been holed up for many weeks. Ukraine's not confirmed the numbers. The fighters who surrendered include members of the far-right Azov battalion. Ukrainian officials have called for a prisoner swap, but some Russian politicians are calling for the soldiers to be put on trial or executed. The New York Times reports talks to end the war in Ukraine have collapsed, with Russian and Ukrainian negotiators further apart from an agreement than at any other point during the war. Russia claims Ukraine still has not responded to a draft peace agreement it submitted April 15th. The Times reports Ukraine has been bolstered by a flood of weapons from the United States and its allies. The U.S. Senate is expected to vote today to approve an additional $40 billion in military and economic aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, leaders of France, Germany, and Italy are publicly calling for negotiations to end the war. On Friday, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz wrote on Twitter, quote, "There must be a ceasefire in Ukraine as quickly as possible." He made the comment after a call with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Last week, French President Emmanuel Macron told the European Parliament Europe's duty should be to achieve a ceasefire, not wage war with Russia. The Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi has also embraced pushing for negotiations to reach a ceasefire. Bloomberg's reporting the United States is preparing to offer India $500 million in military aid as part of an effort to reduce India's dependence on Russian arms. India is currently the world's largest purchaser of Russian weapons. President Biden is expected to meet with the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi next week at a summit in South Korea. The Pentagon's decided not to hold anyone accountable for an airstrike in the Syrian town of Baghouz in March of 2019 that left as many as 70 women and children dead. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin ordered a full review of the attack after the New York Times disclosed details of the strike last year. According to the Times, the death toll was almost immediately apparent to military officials, with one legal officer flagging the attack as a possible war crime. But the Pentagon covered up key details about the strike. The bombing was carried out by a classified special operations unit known as Task Force 9. Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby spoke Tuesday.
We're admitting that, yes, we killed some innocent civilians, women and children, in 2019 in Baghouz, Syria. It's all out there for you to see. We're admitting that we made those mistakes, that we killed, that our operations ended up in the killing of innocent people.
The U.S. Treasury Department's eased some sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry as part of an effort to increase oil supplies to Europe. Bloomberg reports the agreement could also eventually lead to the U.S.-based company Chevron resuming operations in Venezuela. The announcement comes just over 2 months after the Biden administration sent senior officials to Caracas. U.S. officials say the sanctions were lifted to promote talks between the government of Nicolas Maduro and opposition leaders. The Justice Department has asked the House committee investigating the January 6 assault on the U.S. Capitol to hand over its transcripts of witness depositions. But the panel has rejected the request. The chair of the panel, Congressmember Benny Thompson, told reporters the depositions were the property of the committee. And a new study in the Lancet's Planetary Health Journal finds pollution kills 9 million people across the globe annually, with the death toll attributed to emissions from cars and industry rising 55% since the year 2000. The study claims pollution kills approximately the same number of people per year as cigarette smoking and secondhand smoke combined. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
When we come back, primary voters went to the polls in five states Tuesday. Many chose progressive Democratic candidates. We'll look at the Republican and Democratic primaries. Stay with us.
So tired of pretending to enjoy your false company, and now that the weight has been lifted, there's a gladness in my heart that's returned.
Company by Garcia Peoples. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in New Jersey. Voters went to the polls in Tuesday's primary elections in Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Oregon, North Carolina, and Idaho. In Pennsylvania, State Senator Doug Mastriano won the Republican gubernatorial primary. Mastriano is a far-right politician who backed the overturning of the 2020 presidential election and funded charter buses to take supporters to Washington on January 6, ahead of the insurrection. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania's closely watched Republican Senate primary is too close to call. Television doctor Mehmet Oz, who is backed by Donald Trump, has a narrow lead over hedge fund executive Dave McCormick, though he's expected to make up a lot of the difference with mail-in votes. The winner will face Democrat John Fetterman, who defeated Congressmember Connor Lamb, even though Lamb was endorsed by much of Pennsylvania's Democratic establishment. Fetterman, who's Pennsylvania's current lieutenant governor, had to miss his victory party Tuesday night. He suffered a stroke on Friday and spent primary day in a hospital where he had a pacemaker implanted. In other races, the progressive candidate Summer Lee has declared victory over Steve Irwin in a closely watched congressional race in Pennsylvania, but the race hasn't been called yet. Irwin received major funding from AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and the Democratic Majority for Israel. She addressed supporters last night. In North Carolina, the Trump-backed Republican Congressmember Madison Cawthorn lost the primary Tuesday. The 26-year-old was seen as a rising star in the Republican Party, but his campaign faltered after a slew of scandals, including allegations of insider trading. Also in North Carolina, Trump-endorsed Ted Budd beat incumbent and former governor Pat McCrory. Meanwhile, in Idaho, Trump-endorsed Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeachin lost her primary to incumbent Governor Brad Little. And in Kentucky, Charles Booker has won the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate, becoming the first black candidate in Kentucky to win a major party nomination for the U.S. Senate. He'll face Republican Senator Rand Paul in November. For more, we're joined by two guests. We'll begin with David Sirota, investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Lever, editor-at-large for Jacobin, and former advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. In a few minutes, we'll turn also to Nina Turner, who earlier this month lost her Ohio congressional primary after facing massive spending and attacks by super PACs. David, let's begin with you. You have a piece headlined, "They're Not Even Pretending Anymore. Democratic leaders are joining with oligarchs to try to permanently destroy the progressive movement." But why don't we go through the states and the primaries that you feel are most significant right now?
Sure. I mean, I think the leadership and the super PACs that you mentioned really did make an effort to rig these primaries, many of which you've reviewed the results on, to rig them in a way to preference corporate candidates. There was a lot, millions of dollars that flooded into the key races in Oregon and Pennsylvania and North Carolina to try to preference the conservative candidates over the progressive candidates in those races. And there's some good news this morning, as you mentioned, which is that many of the progressive candidates seem to, at least right now, seem to have overcome that effort to defeat them. Summer Lee, a great example, a huge amount of money spent by AIPAC and the DMFI super PAC to try to preference Steve Irwin, a guy who had been a corporate lawyer running union avoidance at a corporate law firm, trying to preference him over state representative Summer Lee. It looks like if the results hold that she will win that race. In Oregon, two congressional races out there, Kurt Schrader, the incumbent Democrat, he had cast a key vote to kill President Biden and Democrats' drug pricing legislation. He was very tight with the pharmaceutical industry. A pharmaceutical front group put a lot of money into that race to try to preference him in that race. President Joe Biden endorsed Schrader, despite Schrader playing that pivotal role trying to stop Biden's own purported agenda. It looks like his opponent is going to defeat him in that race. Also in Oregon, a crypto billionaire, one of Joe Biden's biggest donors, put a ton of money into a separate race for a relatively unknown candidate, and a state representative, Andrea Salinas, ended up winning that race. So I think that one of the takeaways, and then you add in, of course, the Fetterman race, where he won that primary in Pennsylvania for Senate. Taken together, I think what you've seen is a surprising backlash at the voter level to all of the money that flooded in. And it's been a pretty good night for progressive candidates, despite all that money.
And David, could you talk a little more about Pennsylvania? Obviously, it's always a critical state. Talk about the Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman, the front runner in the Pennsylvania race. What is a little of Fetterman's history, if you can, as well as of the Republican candidates in that race?
Sure. Look, Fetterman is a guy who had run for Senate before. He actually ran in a primary to defeat an incumbent and win the lieutenant governor's slot a few years back. He is a progressive candidate. He has run as kind of an anti-establishment candidate. And I should have mentioned before, a couple of these candidates portrayed themselves on the campaign trail as kind of the opposite of Joe Manchin. And that includes John Fetterman. So John Fetterman running as the opposite of Joe Manchin in a state that neighbors West Virginia, and then winning that contested primary. Again, I think that's a huge thing in that race. And Fetterman won in a race where there were many candidates, and one candidate, Connor Lamb, the incumbent congressman, had gotten backing from a lot of the state's political Democratic political machinery. Had a super PAC come in for him, a super PAC that the Lever reported had links to the health insurance industry. And Fetterman ended up nonetheless winning that primary. And so, again, I think that's a very, very big success for the progressive movement. Fetterman is organized seen as the progressive candidate. Him being able to win such a high-profile primary, I think, against the establishment, that is a significant blow to the Democratic establishment.
Even as he had a stroke and had a pacemaker put in on Election Day.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's to his credit in the sense of how much organizing and how much grassroots support that he had. And I should add, he made the case throughout the state that the Democrats keep putting up effectively centrist candidates, quote unquote centrists, corporate aligned candidates who have trouble winning working class voters. So Fetterman, it seems, is making an argument that Democrats have to win back the working class, and the way to do it is to make more progressive populist arguments.
And the Republicans in that race, Dr. Oz seems to have a slight, a tiny lead right now in that race.
That's right. We don't know who the nominee is going to be. It's Dr. Oz versus another candidate who comes from Wall Street, are kind of neck and neck in that race. Look, I think Dave McCormick, the other candidate, if he wins, he could end up being a tougher general election nominee in the sense that he could portray himself kind of as a Glenn Youngkin-like candidate, that candidate who is now the governor of Virginia, who had sort of one foot in the Trump movement and then one foot in the business community. So I think Oz potentially is a weaker candidate in the general election, but we don't know who's going to be there. Of course, you mentioned the Mastriano race and the governor's race. That's also a hugely important race nationally and in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is a purple state, a swing state, but there's been such gerrymandering in that state that there's a Republican legislature. If the state and Doug Mastriano is a far right Republican gubernatorial nominee going up against Josh Shapiro, the Democrat nominee, a guy who I grew up with. I happen to know Josh Shapiro for 40 years, grew up in my town, who is a progressive candidate who has gone up against Trump election deniers, has prosecuted a student debt company, a major pipeline company. If Mastriano wins that race, the Republican legislature could very quickly end abortion rights at the state level in that state. And as you alluded to, Mastriano could, and the Republican legislature could also send Republican electors in the 2024 presidential campaign, and despite what voters in Pennsylvania decide in that campaign. So that gubernatorial race, I would argue, is one of the most important races in the entire country.
And I wanted to ask you about something that was not on the ballot yesterday, but will be very important come November, is what's the redistricting in New York State. The Democrats there attempted to basically politically gerrymander the state to counter what Republicans have been doing in other other states. That was thrown out by the courts, and now the imposed redistricting lines have pitted a whole bunch of veteran Democrats in very tough situations. Jerry Nadler has now been put into a district with Carolyn Maloney. They're going to have to fight each other. You have veterans like Hakeem Jeffries, who's considered a potential Speaker of the House and Nydia Velazquez being redrawn out of their own districts, that they're no longer living in the districts that they represent. Could you talk about whether this attempt by the Democrats in New York has essentially backfired on them?
Yeah, I mean, it sure looks like that. It looks like a situation where Republicans could actually make gains in New York. And if you believe the polls at the top of the ticket, Joe Biden's approval ratings, I think Democrats are facing headwinds. So you've got a situation in New York where Democrats could have maximized their representation. And because of this court process, you have a situation where Republicans are going to have a lot more potentially a lot more competitive races to run in a year when Joe Biden may pull down parts of the ticket. So you may have a situation where a reliably blue state is actually producing more Republicans for the House of Representatives, which could prove decisive to the midterm elections in terms of the House majority.
This issue, of course, of redistricting is very important all over the country. We're speaking to David Sirota, investigative journalist, founder of the news website The Lever, editor-at-large for Jacobin, and a former advisor for Bernie Sanders during his presidential campaign. He wrote a piece this week headlined, "They're Not Even Pretending Anymore. Democratic leaders are joining with oligarchs to try to permanently destroy the progressive movement." I also want to bring into this conversation Nina Turner, the progressive former Ohio State Senator who earlier this month lost her race for Ohio's 11th congressional seat after facing massive spending and attacks by super PACs. She co-chaired Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign. Nina, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your take on the primaries yesterday, and particularly the role of big money and how you saw it playing out. And then we'd like you to talk about what you saw happening in your own race.
Sure. I certainly agree with my colleague, David Sirota, that there are some wins from yesterday for progressives. But here is the caution here, that we know that these super PACs, along with the corporatist Dems, and as David laid out, the oligarchs, because that's exactly what they are, when you have cryptocurrency billionaires, oil baronesses, other corporate interests infusing or injecting themselves into these local races, it is a problem because what they do is they drown out the voices and the will. We don't truly know what the will of the people would be if these super PACs would not jump in the way that they do. And they they particularly target women of color and going even deeper than that, Black women. So let's take State Representative Summer Lee. She had a 25-point lead before they came in there. That is very reminiscent of the lead that I had last year. When these forces jumped in there, they closed in and it was a squeaker, and it still is a squeaker to this moment, although the representative is claiming victory, a victory that was hard fought, but it should not have ever been that close. And thank God you had some Democratic leaders in her state, in cities, that stood up to both AIPAC and DMFI and called it out and called it what it was. And so I am so proud of her and the work that her team has done. In other races, you know, that whether or not a progressive won or lost is no reflection these days on how hard their respective teams were working. I should know it is very much a reflection on this dark money, super PAC money that comes in to sway the will of the voters. And one more point on this, Amy, and those forces do not care about the quality of life or lack thereof of the people who actually live, work, and play in these communities. All they care about is buying elections. And this caution is vitally important for all of those of us who do believe in democracy, regardless of what candidate you support. This is about making sure that the voices of the people who actually live in these communities are not drowned out. And that is happening all over this country. It's coming to a district near you.
And Nina Turner, could you talk about the role of AIPAC and the Democratic Majority for Israel in your race and why they felt it was so important to defeat you?
Well, twice. I mean, they spent over a combined between the special election last year and the election this year, upwards of $6 million combined. Last year in the special election, $12 million was spent. That's between both, you know, campaigns and the super PACs who came in. Very expensive a race for a seat that is a Democratic seat. You know, certainly I was told by some of my allies and some allies that I have who do the dance with the corporatist side from time to time, but they support me. Ask the question, you know, why are these people coming at you like this? And I'm just talking about the alliance between corporatist Democrats and these super PACs. And this person was told that I was not the right kind of Democrat. And that they meant that I don't bend, that I come from the Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm school of Democrats, and that is unbought and unbossed. These people are pouring in this kind of money because they want to be able to control the outcomes that happen on the congressional level. This is it, plain and simple. You don't invest that kind of money without expecting a return. There's nothing so spectacular about the people who they endorse and who they supported, whether it was my race in particular, especially so, or any other races across the country. They are investing in corporatist type Democrats because they want a return on the investment. Let's look at the Iran deal. Many of us remember that that was one of the biggest foreign policy accomplishments of President Obama's presidency. You got President Biden pushing for that. And you have the person who benefited from DMFI PAC money and AIPAC money standing against with other Democrats. I think it was about 18 in total against that deal. One great example of them getting a return on their investment right away. But what happens in a district like mine? Ohio is the poorest city in the country right now. The poorest. One in every two children go to bed hungry at night. You have suffering in Cleveland and the greater Cleveland area, but those PACs that come in here, they don't care about that. You think that cryptocurrency billionaire care whether or not the babies in Cleveland or greater Cleveland get a chance to eat or whether their parents are making the living wage? No, they don't care about that. All they wanted to do was to buy the election. So they rented it last year. They flat out bought it this year. And so elections are being decided in boardrooms instead of ballot boxes.
But Nina Turner, what does that say about the well-known progressives in Congress? I mean, you have last year, when you ran in the special election, the Congressional Progressive Caucus supported you. But this year, they endorsed your opponent, who had become, of course, the incumbent, Congressmember Chantel Brown. Why do you think this is? And then you have the many CPC progressive members, Pramila Jayapal, Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, Ayanna Pressley, Rashida Tlaib, Jamal Bowman, who didn't endorse any candidate this year, though they did you last year.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't answer for the individuals. I mean, they have to make a decision for themselves as to why people get a right to endorse or not endorse. And I get that as a political person. I truly get that. What I will say about the Congressional Progressive Caucus as a whole is that they were wrong. And I'm really excited to see progressive leaders across the country. And I'm talking about leaders who lead caucuses from California to Nevada to New Mexico to Iowa. People, those progressive leaders, it was about 11 of them in total all across the country. Once the CPC did what they did, they came out and made it very clear who the real freedom fighting progressive in my race was. And I applaud them, and I hope that they stay together and continue to do those things. The progressive leadership, elected leadership, has a decision to make. Either they are going to side with corporatist Democrats and not do anything that is immensely different from them, or they are going to be the difference. Either they're going to complement the movement or they are not. I will say that Congresswoman Jayapal, in an article, I think was in Punch Bowl, did say after being pressed, because the movement pressed the CPC, they didn't do this on their own, saying that they may have to rethink or they should rethink how they do endorsements, not to endorse people right away, and to also look at what type of entities are supporting these candidates to determine whether or not they are truly progressive. The person in my race joined that caucus because she knew full well that I was going to run again. It was all for cover. But people are suffering in this country, all over this country, not in just in my district. And we need the progressives inside that Congress to be the ones who stand up and call it what it is. That was not done in my race this time around. I do want to thank Senator Bernie Sanders. He was with me the first time, with me the second time. And Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez came in as well. So I do appreciate that.
And briefly, your thoughts in terms heading into the November elections, so what the prospects look for progressive candidates and a progressive agenda move forward?
Yeah, the agenda is strong. We know that the overwhelming of the American people, if you don't put the label on it, they agree with that agenda. People, look, gas in Ohio is $4.55. It is continuing to go up. It's going up all over the country. The minimum wage here is $8.80, a little higher than the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25. Well, look at what people have to do just to survive. They are barely surviving. So the agenda that is being put forward by those on my side of this movement, Medicare for all, living wages, making sure people can unionize, protecting voting rights, the overwhelming majority of people believe in it. What is missing is intestinal fortitude on the side of the Democratic Party. Democratic Party as a whole have to make a decision. Is it the party of the corporatists or is it going to be the party of the people? So far, it is failing and proven that it is the party of the corporatists. For example, the child tax credit expired. That cut childhood poverty in half, which was a beautiful thing, a tremendous policy push by the Biden administration, gone. So now those same children that were pulled out are now back in at a critical moment where you got the pandemic still waging. Be done with the pandemic. Pandemic is not done with us. And then you have inflation that is eating every little dollar that the poor, the working poor, and the barely middle class have. So I want to say to the progressive movement, let's stay. We're going to keep on pushing for these, for the policies that change material conditions. And the Democratic Party has a decision to make. And one more point on that. They will
have 10 seconds.
The corporatist wing of the Democratic Party will do anything to try to defeat progressive candidates. We cannot stand for that. We must continue to fight, and we will.
Nina Turner, progressive former Ohio State Senator, co-chaired Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, and David Sirota, journalist and founder of The Lever, former advisor for Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. When we come back, a rare interview from the front lines of the Battle of Donbas in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Стефанія, мамо, мамо, Стефанія, розквітає поле, а вона сивіє. Заспівай мені, мамо, колискову, хочу ще почути твоє рідне слово.
Вона мене колесала, дала мені ритм, і напевне сило волі не забрати мене, бо дала вона, напевне знала, може більше і відсоламана. Ломаними дорогами прийду я завжди до тебе, вона не розбудить, не будить. Мене в сині бурі забере бабулі з вітулі, ніби вони кулі. Дуже добре знала мене, не була обманута, як було дуже втомлена, гойдала мене так.
Stefania by the Ukrainian folk rap group Kalush Orchestra. The group won the 2022 Eurovision Song Contest over the weekend in Italy. They then went back to Ukraine and were honored by President Zelensky. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show on the front lines of the war in Ukraine. In the city of Mariupol, the Russian military says nearly 1,000 Ukrainian fighters surrendered in total after leaving the Azovstal steel plant where they've been holed up for many weeks. This comes as the New York Times reports talks to end the war have collapsed, with Russian and Ukrainian negotiators further apart from an agreement than at any other point during the war. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate is expected to vote today to approve additional $40 billion in military and economic aid to Ukraine. On Tuesday, in a rare interview on the front lines, I spoke to the independent journalist William Billy Nesson, who's in the Ukrainian town of Severodonetsk, east of Kramatorsk, which is right up against the Russian lines under constant shelling. After having some trouble connecting with him, we did manage to reach him, although there were explosions throughout the broadcast until they blew the video image off the air, though Billy could continue to speak. This is what he had to say. Billy, you just came back. Can you tell us? We didn't hear a word you said. Can you tell us what you're doing there? What's happening in the city?
Okay, well, this is the explosions now. I would say probably 3 minutes, mostly shells going back and forth between the Ukrainian forces and the Russian forces. The city of 130,000 is a strategic point, a barometer of which way this thing is going to go. If the Ukrainians can hold the city, I think it's the end of any Russian advances, at least in this part of the country. And so far, the Russians have made several attempts after constant artillery barrages to get into the city over the last couple of weeks, starting about the 7th or 8th. They first came from the east, then came from the north, and then have tried to encircle the city and cut it off from the city just to its west. So there's fighting on the outskirts of the city. It's mostly an artillery duel that goes on probably 3 shells a minute, I'm counting. It'll go 24/7. The place where I sleep at night in a basement was hit by about 50 shells all around it. Even though there's no strategic, there's no military or police or anything essential to the Ukrainians, they often, besides barraging the Ukrainian forces, some days they just start shelling the city. And there seems to be no logic or reason for some of the places that they attack. They have drones operating over the city, both the Russians and Ukrainians, so they know what they're hitting and not hitting. The hospital was hit several times last week. I was in a sports palace that was hit 3 times. The office where I was working at, which is a humanitarian center, well, the back part of it was hit by a rocket. And then a few days ago, a mortar went through the roof. If I had been sitting in the chair where I usually sit, I would have been killed.
So talk about the people who are there. Do you want to put on your helmet? I mean, I can't bear to be interviewing you as we hear these explosions in the background.
Yeah, no, I'm okay. I'm okay if it gets a little bit closer. I mean, what happens here after you've been here for a little bit, you can judge what's coming in close and what's not. And the streets are, it's a city of 130,000. There's probably 15,000 people left. And you walk, most of the streets that I've walked down are completely empty. And occasionally you see people walking out and about. But people are used to the shelling and they can judge what's close and what's not. You know, 100 meters, 200 meters, 300 meters, that's considered close. Half a K, you know, no one even flinches anymore. The people who are left are overwhelmingly older people who are used to being here and don't want to leave. You know, they're scared to leave. And accompanying them are their children who are adults, you know, in their 40s. So you have this older population and then you have a next generation. And then complicating that is the fact that the next generation has children. So the whole family ends up staying here. There's evacuations going on, but the people who are here right now, it's unlikely that they're going to leave. As I said, the Russians are trying to take the city, and this will be a barometer of the war.
Billy Nessen, yeah. You've had a long, storied career in journalism. You worked for the United Nations covering South Africa in South Africa. In the Global South, there is a lot of criticism of the United States and NATO really provoking this war, not to say there isn't criticism of the brutality of the invasion, but the ever-eastern inching of NATO toward Russia. And now you have Sweden and Finland saying they're going to join. Why did you decide to come to Ukraine?
You know, I've not only been a journalist, but I was an activist much of my life and working and oriented toward issues of the South or what we used to call the Third World. So I am very much attuned to that. And I'd actually put down my—I'd stopped working as a journalist—
and it focused on raising a family. And when Russia invaded Ukraine, I thought I had to come here. I can understand the perceptions that the South has of that this is somehow a battle of West and East, or of some part of the world versus American imperialism. But I thought, even though those issues are there, I thought there was also a Russian imperialism. And if you know the history and the perceptions of people all around Russia, you begin to understand that there is something called Russian imperialism, and at times it can be worse than American imperialism. And I thought this was one of the times.
We're talking to you right as the soldiers have given up, the Ukrainians, at the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol. How much information are you getting about that? What effect does that have on the Ukrainians where you are?
I mean, We have an internet. So I should say that we don't have cell phones. We don't have any water. We don't have electricity except a generator. And we've got this Starlink from Elon Musk is the only way that we're speaking to you. I mean, everyone's cooking outside. There's no fuel to cook. There's just wood. I saw people and filmed people cutting down dead trees today in order to cook the food. People here are staying alive because of the humanitarian aid that's coming in. And I'm speaking to you from the large center of that. So we get news from the outside, and we also hear from talking to soldiers and special forces and the police every day. People see that and that situation, Mariupol, and those people who fought there as heroes, as their lions, they call them. And it even though they have now been defeated, they see it as an enormous victory of Ukraine. They're going to fight. They see it as an existential question. If they don't fight, then Russia's going to take over. So there's no choice for them. And they, as I say, they look to the Mariupol defenders as the heroes of this country. If Putin wanted to get rid of the Nazis, you know, or the fascists, as he called them, Nazis or fascists, he's actually ennobled those people who by the West were considered, conservative or right wing or fascist. I think that's, you know, we get a lot more information from talking to people. I've talked to people in the Azov battalion or brigade. They exist all throughout eastern Ukraine, and they long ago were put into the National Guard, and they're professional. And they, for a lot of people, the fight that they wage shows how professional they are.
Can you talk about the Azov Battalion, the brigade? I mean, for people here who have been following it for years, it's a white supremacist right-wing brigade. And the idea that you're saying that have become mainstreamed, I mean, there was a time when the U.S. was put restrictions on weapons being sent that would end up in the hands of this brigade.
Well, listen, you know, the job first of a journalist, I think, is to communicate what the people in a place feel or think. And then secondarily is the analysis. And I think figuring out exactly who is who and what was what is something that is going to go on for a long time. If you say to them, people here, that Azov are fascist, they laugh at you. You know, or you say that fascists have a lot of support in Ukraine. People say, but the one party that was considered out of 39 parties, I think, that was considered sort of far right or fascist got less than 2% of the vote, I think, in a field of 39 other candidates. Zelensky, he's Jewish. He won 73% of the vote in the second round. You know, I think they're probably more one. They'll also say that here there might be some fascists, but in Russia they're in power, and they look to the vote in France, or they know about Trump, and they think, well, America and France have far more far-right people than they do in Ukraine. People laugh at it. You know, they don't have popular support at all in terms of an ideology, but they've gotten in even more support, Azov, as a fighting unit. But I don't think it's a far-right battalion anymore. It once was, but it's been integrated into the army. And I think people in America and some in Europe on the left generally want to say that that means that the military and then therefore the government is far-right or fascist, rather than that these far right people don't dominate that battalion and don't dominate the military in any way.
Billy, I wanted to ask you about restrictions being put on you by the Ukrainian military or local officials that you can talk about.
Yeah, I'll talk about it at all. I think every journalist and photographer, videographer who's been here, and I do all three, very frustrated by it. We've been stopped from covering the war itself. No one has gotten, or rarely, it's sort of accidentally that anyone has gotten to the front lines covering the war. They might be there in some battle or something happens, but we've been chaperoned everywhere, and I think it's a huge mistake by the Ukrainian government, and you know, that's one of the troubling things that every journalist here has encountered.
Why do they say they're imposing it, Billy?
They say they're concerned with our safety, and we respond, but we came here knowing the danger. That we know the dangers.
Why don't you put on your helmet?
You know, I'm still in a safe place, just still loud. It echoes in here. That was pretty close. So that's the first thing they say. There are safety, and we try to explain, and they ignore that. And then the other thing is, you know, they're worried that that we'll give out some sort of military secrets, but which is also silly because, as I said, you have drones flying all over, and there are people, especially here, who do support Russia. So, you know, within this 10% of the population that stayed in this city, I've met a number of them who are pro-Russia. And these people will obviously give information, or not obviously, but they're more likely to give information about placement of Ukrainian troops than any of the journalists who come.
Billy's an American. Do you think the United States is doing enough to end the war, or is the U.S. helping to prolong it?
As an American, I think the right thing is to help the Ukrainians.
And if you can talk more about the civilians. Go ahead.
Against an invasion, we should do everything we can to help them.
Are you the only American there? Have you seen American advisors there? Can you talk about people from around the world that you've met where you are?
Yeah. I'm in contact with some soldiers and police here. I've met, but overwhelmingly, the people that I've met here in this town have been humanitarian aid workers, and they're 99% are Ukrainians. But there are a number of, you know, Japanese, Belgian, Swiss, American. I met the guy from Mexico today. People are still being evacuated from here, and they have to go along a road which is shelled by the Russians. So these humanitarian aid workers are very brave to drive in a big van. You're driving 20 old elderly people. You know, that was loud. That was close.
That was very loud. We heard it, the explosion right there, and you froze for a minute.
Yeah. So I'm not seeing, you know, the American advisors are probably here. I mean, and I'm sure they're giving them real-time access to every bit of information that the American satellites and European British spy satellites and other means are able to gather. Obviously, the West is determined that Ukraine has to win this war. Our listeners or viewers might have different feelings about that, but I think it's clear that the determination is there. And we're not seeing, obviously, a lot of what's going on. There have been foreign fighters here, but I think a lot of them are, from what I hear from Ukrainians, not very effective ones. There are probably some. You know, it's mostly not ex-special forces.
Billy?
Yeah.
Billy, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Just right next door to us.
My God.
Landed right here.
Billy, your helmet.
Yeah, I'm inside now. Whoa.
Tell us what's happening. Just describe it to us, even though we don't have an image. I can hear you.
Explosion right next door. We don't have a video?
No, we don't have video right now.
No, explosion, the smoke all up and down. The shell hit right next door this building.
It looks like your camera turned off.
Yeah, I don't know, all sorts of things. I don't know what happened, but that's the very close, within 100 meters, less than 50 meters away.
We can...
That's where there's a lot of people sort of camped out in a bunker over there. People have been made homeless right where it hit. There's no military targets over there. This is... ridiculous.
And again, describe where you are. Talk about the hospital.
I'm in a humanitarian aid center, and just 50 meters or 100 meters away is where a lot of people are living underground, and that's where that shell hit. It's an empty lot with people cooking outside.
Do you see people fleeing, scattering?
No, I can't see because it's blocked by the truck. It's all smoke. You can't see anything. They're not going to just hit one shell. We gotta go inside. Yeah.
Billy, should we let you go so that you can deal with everything?
No, it's okay. It's okay. That hit right. I mean, I was the closest person to it. What else do you? I'm sorry. What else do you want to ask?
Do you have the sense that the Russians like NATO and Ukraine working together? Do you have the sense that they know what they're hitting?
They know what they're hitting. They've got drones all over the city. They know exactly what they're hitting. These are not mistakes. This is their. They 99% of the shells are hitting Ukrainian troops. But 1% is enough to kill lots of people here. This isn't where there's basically homeless people. It's like, you know, a Plaza Moscone Center, you know.
Are there many children left there?
Yeah, there are children there. Anyway, that's homeless people over there, old people.
And the hospital that has been hit a number of times, is it still functioning? Yeah. Is it the only hospital in Severodonetsk?
There's two. There's a military hospital. They keep hitting the civilian hospital. You know, they know it's a big building. I mean, there's no mistakes here. You know, there's drones flying. Yesterday, I saw a unit of Ukrainians shooting down a drone. I heard a buzzing in the air. You know, that's a drone. And Ukrainians shot it out of the air. I was there. So they know exactly what they're doing. I mean, they could level this town, and they're not doing that, but 1%. So every building in the city has its windows have been broken. Almost every block, there's been an explosion. A rocket or artillery or mortar round has landed. You know, it's not level, but this is like, slow motion. You know, mass destruction of the city.
Did we lose Billy? Billy, if you're speaking, we don't hear you. After that, we lost contact with independent journalist Billy Nessen, who's in the Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk, right up against the Russian lines under constant shelling. It's the easternmost city still held by Ukrainian forces after almost 3 months of war. We later did hear from him yesterday that he was okay, at least for now. We've tried to reach him today, and we haven't been able to reach him yet. That does it for today's show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz and Hani Massoud. Very happy birthday belated to Aaron Dooley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thank you.